Good morning, Colorado. You're listening to the Daily Sun Up with the Colorado Sun. It's Thursday, January 19th. Today, environmental reporter Michael Booth and health reporter John Ingold discuss an ambitious wastewater recycling program in Aurora and a new COVID variant that could impact Colorado. Before we begin, the Colorado Sun's inaugural Best of the Colorado Sun is officially open for voting. Vote for your favorite businesses and people across the state now through February 28th. You can cast your vote once per region. Visit coloradosun.com/bestof to vote today. Now, let's go back in time with some Colorado history. On this day, in 1948, after nearly a quarter century of both economic prosperity and ethnic tension, a fire destroyed what had been the most productive lumber mill in Colorado. The mill site and the town now sit at the bottom of McPhee Reservoir. The timber industry flourished in southwestern Colorado by the early 20th century. After World War I, the Denver firm McPhee and McGinnity moved disused machinery from exhausted timber fields elsewhere to the San Juan National Forest. They opened a mill on the Dolores River in early 1924 and platted a town around it, named after company founder William McPhee. By the autumn, McPhee boasted a link to the Rio Grande Southern Railroad and shipped lumber to customers as far away as New England. But McPhee declined in the 1940s, with many of its workers leaving for military service or better-paying jobs during World War II. By the decade's end, the company had changed hands several times, and the January 1948 blaze finished off the mill and the community. What was once the largest lumber operation in Colorado disappeared. And by the early 1990s, construction of McPhee Reservoir on the Dolores River inundated the once bustling site. Before we continue, a quick message. The Colorado Sun presents The Next Food Revolution: Growing Greens in the Air with environment reporter Michael Booth. Join the virtual event on February 9th to hear how a company is using a storage container to grow crops, how CU Boulder is growing greens in a sunroom, and much more. Register for the free event at coloradosun.com/events. Next, our feature story.
Well, hi everyone. Happy Thursday. Thursday is the day where Mike Booth and I get together and talk about health and climate stories. These are often first reported in our premium newsletter that's called The Temperature. So you can go to coloradosun.com if you want more information on how to sign up for those. But hey, Mike, how are you doing?
Doing well, thanks, John. We have uncovered our microphones and laptops from the snowbanks and ready to roll.
So you have a really interesting story today about what I think has to be one of our favorite topics at the Colorado Sun, which is wastewater and things you can do with it. But with that tease, maybe you can explain more.
Aurora Water has quite the MacGyver system, as we put it in the story, for trying to reuse some of its water. As we all know from being Colorado Sun reporters and readers and fans of everything in the Southwest, we're in the middle of a 22-year drought. We need to make some severe cuts to what we're using from the Colorado River in order to meet federal requirements and just keep enough water in Lake Powell and Lake Mead. And so basically every municipality who's trying to participate, trying to contribute some conservation, both just to contribute to the general ethics of being a Westerner, but also in order to save money. As Aurora puts it, the water you already own is the cheapest water you're going to get in Colorado. So they have an innovative project already in place called Prairie Waters that allows the water that people use in Aurora to brushing their teeth or whatever they're doing, flushing their toilets, goes down through the wastewater system and the streams to Metro Water Recovery. And it's treated there, sent back into the South Platte River and heads about 20 miles to Fort Lupton. And there, Aurora has dug some wells that actually go under the riverbank and radiate out to into the sand and gravel. And they basically let the sand and gravel from the riverbanks clean out a lot of the South Platte River water. And then they suck it back up through pumps, put it through some more gravel, and then send it 60 miles south to their Binney water treatment plant, which is right near Aurora Reservoir. And they treat it some more and get it up to drinking water standards and put it back into the Aurora water pipes to go to people's houses. And it seems like a complicated system, but as Western water goes, it makes a lot of sense. And now what we were able to do on Friday is join some federal officials. The Assistant Secretary of the Interior came out to hand Aurora a virtual check for $5 million to double the size of the system.
So one of the things I found interesting about the story is that when this recovered, rejuvenated, reclaimed wastewater gets back into the system, it ends up being mixed in with some of the snowmelt mountain runoff water that they're already using. And it kind of struck me that this potentially helps with the ick factor of using treated wastewater and sending it back out for drinking purposes.
Absolutely. And that kind of dilution actually happens a lot more than we hear about throughout water systems in the West, in that you get water that's not perfect, whether it's gone through industrial areas of the South Platte in the cities, or it's gone through wildfire areas and picked up ash and taste and odors that are not dangerous to your health, but they kind of degrade the aesthetic quality of the water. And so one reason that Aurora mixes in the mountain fresh water from the reservoir is to get back to that aesthetic quality and just ensure they always like to have a broader source as possible to, you know, just clean up the supply and make it as broad and healthy as possible.
Well, let's switch gears here and talk about a different story you wrote in the last week. This one about some residents of Colorado mountain streams, our fish population, and some chemicals that have been found in them.
Yes, unfortunately, the more we look for PFAS forever chemicals is a phrase that most people have heard, the more we find them. To test for it in the United States, almost anywhere in any situation, is to find more of it. These are the chemicals that go into things like nonstick or repellent coatings like Teflon or Gore-Tex clothing or firefighting equipment or your rubber boots or firefighting foam itself, because it allows it to flow and not burn up. And so these chemicals, the problem with them is they're incredibly useful, but they also never degrade, and they are a threat to human health in heavy concentrations. And we've been using them since the 1950s and 60s in tens of thousands of consumer products, everything from carpet to kitchen pots to your toothbrush handles to the clothing you wear. And it runs off everywhere, from the streams, just from running off your clothing into the wastewater in landfills, from industrial pollution. And this test of 500 samples of EPA fish fillets from around the country shows that the concentrations are so heavy in the fish that eating one freshwater fish that you've caught yourself is the equivalent of drinking 1 month's worth of tainted drinking water with PFAS. And so the Amenemhat groups that published this peer-reviewed research paper are warning once again that it's time for the EPA and for Colorado officials in every state to let the public know what is a standard. How much fish can you eat for people who love to fish and do it as a hobby, for people who are lower income and use fish as a real supplement for their diet, and it becomes an environmental justice issue? How much do they need to worry, and how much fish can they consume before it becomes a health problem? So we can pivot from that to some health stories that you've been working on, John. You have been trying to update everybody on the latest variant of COVID coming in. And this one is dubbed the Kraken, which I guess is somewhat better than something like the Reaper, but also a little bit terrifying. So what are we hearing about this particular variant?
Yeah, so we kind of teased this a little bit last week. Its actual name is XBB.1.5. These names get increasingly complicated because we're not just naming them after Greek letters now, because these are all subvariants of Omicron. So yeah, it's kind of the big variant that's sweeping the East Coast right now and leading to some real big waves of infection. And so the thought would be, are we going to end up seeing the same thing here in Colorado? And it's actually been a little bit of an interesting story. It's not exactly new to Colorado. It's here. It still makes up an estimated minority of our cases, but it's also been around for weeks. XBB.1.5 is often described as being the most transmissible COVID variant that we've seen to date. Well, you remember what happened when the original Omicron variant came into the state. Cases shot up, I mean, like a rocket. Like, they shot up almost instantaneously. We haven't really seen that yet with this new XBB variant. So that kind of lends the question of why, and what does this mean for what's going to happen here? One thing in talking with a couple epidemiologists in the state, one thing they both pointed out was that Colorado had recently been through a wave of COVID cases driven by different kinds of variants, different Omicron subvariants. And those cases are falling. Our cases actually continue to fall right now. At least as of the most recent data. And so the thought is that maybe that recent wave gave us a little bit of extra protection that is, at least for the time being, holding this XBB.1.5 variant at bay. The other thing is there is some kind of mysterious seasonality sometimes to COVID. You know, we obviously Often we'll see COVID spikes starting in late summer and early fall. But in Colorado, those spikes often end around mid to late November, early December. And that's kind of what happened again this year. So if for whatever reason now in Colorado is an unfavorable time for COVID transmission, that could also be helping us. But then there's the other question of, okay, well, we will eventually get out of this period. Eventually, the immunity from that most recent wave will start to wear off a little bit. Then do we get hit with this new variant? And what happens then? And the thought is that it would be pretty consistent with some of the more recent COVID waves that we've had. So that would include potentially lots of illness, lots of infection, but maybe not as much severe illness as we would have seen during earlier waves, not as much as during the original Omicron wave or the Delta wave. And the expectation is like, unless something really extraordinary happens, we probably won't be seeing a wave out of this Delta or out of this XBB variant that is going to end up overwhelming our hospital system. So a little bit of good news, a little bit of, you know, unknown still, but something to keep an eye on.
So now what health officials don't want is for people to keep hearing about variants and throwing up their hands and saying, what's the point in getting vaccinated? The variants keep coming around. I don't even know if it works. So can you update us on how the vaccinations are working against the new variants that come around and whether the advice has changed at all or whether everybody should keep going out there and trying to bump up our vaccination rates?
Yeah, so definitely the public health guidance is that if you haven't gotten one of the updated booster shots, so these would be sometimes called the bivalent booster shots. They're specifically formulated for Omicron variants, not specifically the XBB variant, but different variants that are sort of cousins of the XBB variant. Yeah, so the recommendation is to go out and get that shot, and that should at least provide you with some protection from severe illness. The other thing to keep in mind is if you are somebody who potentially could be at risk for more severe disease, you have an underlying health condition that may expose you to that, you are older, if you do end up getting COVID, make sure you're reaching out to a doctor because something like Paxlovid, which is the antiviral COVID drug, it's sort of like Tamiflu for COVID, something like that is also effective at reducing illness severity for Omicron subvariants, and it looks like for the XBB variant as well. So it's sort of, sort of getting back to basics, getting back to pandemic basics a little bit. It doesn't necessarily mean locking down in your house and never going out, but it means ordering some new free tests from the federal government. That program is reopened, so you can do that. You can, make sure you know if you have COVID, if you're feeling sick, stay home and make sure you've taken the precautions that you can or are seeking out the treatment you need to if you do get sick.
Thanks for the update. Yeah, we've got a whole shelf full of test kits, and I have friends and family members who have had those discussions about Paxlovid with their doctors. Opinions seem to vary, but it's very important to have that conversation and see if there's something else you could be doing to protect yourself, both in the short term and whether there are opinions out there that can help in long COVID symptoms as well.
Yeah, definitely. Absolutely. All right. Well, I think that'll do it for us this week, folks. Thank you again for spending your time with us. And Mike and I will see you back here next week, and there'll be another great Colorado Sun podcast in the queue for you tomorrow. So thanks.
Read more at coloradosun.com. Finally, here are a few stories that you should know about today. Public school enrollment continues to fall in Colorado as birth rates across the state decline, driving down the per-pupil funding school districts rely on. That reduced funding for some districts could increase the threat of more school closures. The state saw a decrease of nearly 0.4% in enrollment last fall compared with 2021. According to the Colorado Department of Education, there are just over 883,000 students in the state's public schools, down more than 3,200 students from 2021. Of the state's 178 school districts, at least 94 have declining enrollment. The Prairie Waters Project in Aurora is a recycling system that uses water from the South Platte River, treating and cleaning it before sending it back to homes through taps. The project is being expanded with $5 million from the Bipartisan Infrastructure Law, which will double the project's capacity and bring 5,000 to 10,000 more acre-feet of clean water into the system each year. The expansion of the Prairie Waters Project will help meet a portion of Aurora's annual water needs, freeing up mountain runoff water rights for other economic interests important to the state. The number of weapons found in Denver public schools and confiscated from students is skyrocketing. Last school year, 200 weapons were found at Denver schools, including 13 guns and 28 fake guns. That's a fivefold increase from the 40 weapons found in 2018. And this year is likely to be similar. As of late November, the district had recovered 79 weapons, including 7 guns and 17 fake guns. That doesn't count weapons found near schools or shootings that happened just off campus. For more information on all of these stories, visit our website, coloradosun.com. And don't forget to tune in again tomorrow. The Colorado Sun is nonpartisan and completely independent. We're always dedicated to telling the in-depth stories we need today more than ever. And the Sun is supported by readers and listeners like you. Right now, you can head to coloradosun.com and become a member, starting at $5 per month. And if you bump it up to $20 per month, you'll get access to our politics newsletter, The Unaffiliated, as well as our outdoors newsletter, The Outsider, and our health and environment newsletter, The Temperature. All three exclusive newsletters delivered to your inbox every week.